This lecture, Capitalism versus Anti-Capitalism, Reason versus Muscle Mysticism, was originally delivered in April of 1967 on the campus of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville as part of a regional conference on objectivism. It was subsequently delivered before objectivist audiences in several cities, including Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Detroit. It has been lightly edited for the present recording, which retains the original introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a great honor for me to have been invited to speak on the subject of capitalism here in the historic home of American liberty, the state of Virginia, and at the university founded by Thomas Jefferson. I have always known that capitalism was the system for which the founding fathers fought the American Revolution, and it was the certainty of this knowledge that first made me take up its advocacy. So today, in speaking about capitalism, I can speak in the conviction that I am in its spiritual home, helping to raise once again the ideas first propounded in this very place by the historical figures I most admire. Capitalism has been defined by Ayn Rand as, quote, a social system based on the recognition of individual rights, including property rights, in which all property is privately owned, end quote. And in her introduction to the book in which this definition appears, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, Ms. Rand describes what has up to now been its historical fate. Quote, no politico-economic system in history has ever proved its value so eloquently or has benefited mankind so greatly as capitalism, and none has ever been attacked so savagely, viciously, and blindly. The flood of misinformation, misrepresentation, distortion, and outright falsehood about capitalism is such that the young people of today have no idea and virtually no way of discovering any idea of its actual nature. While archaeologists are rummaging through the ruins of millennia for scraps of pottery and bits of bones from which to reconstruct some information about prehistorical existence, the events of less than a century ago are hidden under a mound more impenetrable than the geological debris of winds, floods, and earthquakes, a mound of silence. To obliterate the truth on such a large scale, Miss Rand continues, to hide an open secret from the world, to hide without any power of censorship, yet without any significant sound of protest, the fact that an ideal social system had once been almost within men's reach, cannot be done by any conspiracy of evildoers. It cannot be done except with the tacit compliance of those who know better. By their silence, by their evasion of the clash between capitalism and altruism, it is capitalism's alleged champions who are responsible for the fact that capitalism is being destroyed without a hearing, without a trial, without any public knowledge of its principles, its nature, its history, or its moral meaning. It is being destroyed in the manner of a nightmare lynching, as if a blind, despair-crazed mob were burning a straw man, not knowing that the grotesquely deformed bundle of straw is hiding the living body of the ideal. End quote. My purpose today is to give a brief exposition of the philosophical foundations and nature of capitalism, to set forth what I believe are the basic causes of the opposition to it, and briefly to analyze certain of the major arguments raised against capitalism in relation to these basic causes of opposition to it. For students interested in making a thoroughgoing study of capitalism, the philosophy underlying it, and the answers economic theory gives to its critics, I recommend that you read all of the writings of Ayn Rand and all of the economic writings of Ludwig von Mises and Henry Hazlitt. And then, when you have mastered the economic theories of these authors, in addition to having a basic familiarity with the philosophy of objectivism and wish to go on in economics and the economic defense of capitalism, steep yourself in the writings of Eugen von Bawerk and Karl Menger, and of the old British classical economists, Smith, Ricardo, James Mill, McCulloch, and John Stuart Mill. Above all, Ricardo. The best brief statement of the philosophical foundations of capitalism of which I am aware is that of Nathaniel Brandon in his one super-sentence summary of the philosophy of objectivism. Quote, objectivism holds, A, that existence, reality, the external world, is what it is, independent of man's consciousness, independent of anyone's knowledge, judgment, beliefs, hopes, wishes, or fears, that facts are facts, that A is A, that things are what they are. B, that reason, the faculty that identifies and integrates the material provided by man's senses, is fully competent to know the facts of reality. C, that man's perception of the facts of reality must constitute the basis of his value judgments. That just as reason is his only guide to knowledge, so it is his only guide to action. D, that man is an end in himself, not a means to the ends of others. He must live for his own sake with the achievement of his rational self-interest as the moral purpose of his life, neither sacrificing himself to others nor sacrificing others to himself. E, that no one has the right to seek values from others by the initiation of physical force. End quote. It is on this foundation that capitalism rests, a system based, as Mr. Brandon puts it, on the inviolate supremacy of individual rights, in which the exclusive function of government is the protection of rights. End quote. To summarize Mr. Brandon's summary, each man is an end in himself, and reason is his basic tool of survival. Capitalism is the politico-economic system designed for men who recognize these facts. For men who refuse to recognize them, no system can be designed. For such men, only systematic misery, destruction, and extermination can result. What is meant by the proposition, reason is man's basic tool of survival? Its application to a man on a desert island or alone in a jungle is easy to perceive. Man is no match, either in strength or in the power of his senses, for most of the lower animals. He cannot out-wrestle a gorilla or outrun a lion. His sense of sight, smell, hearing, and touch do not compare favorably with those of cats or dogs. He cannot obtain food as an animal does. His body hair cannot keep him warm as an animal's does. He cannot sleep on a tree branch or in a burrow as an animal does. Were he to attempt to live as an animal, he would be wiped out of existence. To survive, man must think. He must identify his needs and the means of satisfying those needs. He must learn, by a process of abstraction, concept formation, induction and deduction, how to obtain food, how to make clothing, how to construct shelter. In making even his first spear, he has to have the concept of hunger, the concept of animal, the concept of an object to penetrate the animal's hide. None of these things are perceptually present. He has to put these concepts together, to integrate them, and to be guided in his actions by them. The association of other men does not change the fact that at least some men must continue to think. It was only by the thinking of those who chose to make the effort that man went on from jungle savagery to the art of domesticating and breeding animals, to agriculture, to modern industry, to the philosophy, mathematics, physics, biology, and engineering that makes the lives of all of us possible. Man the thinker, in whatever historical period and on whatever level of ability, does not take the world as he finds it. He makes it his business to understand it and then to change it to suit his need. He shapes his environment to himself. He assumes the responsibility for his life. Whether he is a genius who revolutionizes the science of physics, a farmer who clears new land on the frontier of civilization, or an ex-blacksmith who learns how to repair an automobile, the essence is the same. Not to sit back, to drift, to coast on the past thinking of others, but to live as a creator, to make anew for oneself that mental effort to know and understand which man's life requires. Such men, in each generation, are the builders of civilization. Take away all of modern industry, of science, of art, and they would rebuild it, rediscover it, create it once more. They are the only men who deserve the heritage they receive from the past, and the only men who can keep it. Man the thinker enters society not to escape the responsibility of thinking, but to expand the efficacy of his thinking. The association of other rational beings is of incalculable advantage to him. What has taken months, years, or a lifetime to be discovered for the first time can afterwards be taught in comparatively no time, and serve as the starting point for the acquisition of new knowledge. In society, one has access to the thinking of one's contemporaries, and to the cumulative thought of all preceding generations. The efficacy of one's thought is expanded not only by the multiplication of knowledge, which the society of rational men makes possible, but in an equally radical way by the division of knowledge, and by its corollary, the division of labor, which that society makes possible. Interjection. Please note that in capitalism, I regard what I here refer to as the division of knowledge as merely being an aspect of the multiplication of knowledge. Because of the division of knowledge and the division of labor, each man is able to bring to the service of his life, in exchange for the products of his own thinking, the combined intellectual power of the whole of that portion of the human race with which he is directly or indirectly connected by way of the exchange of goods and services. This is in addition to the multiplication of the intellectual power of each already described. Thus, a simple machine operator in a textile mill, a man of perhaps limited intellectual capacity, has the power of his thought expanded first by that of all the thinking men past and present, who directly or indirectly contribute to the knowledge he requires to help produce textiles, from Aristotle to Newton to Arkwright to his employer to his foreman, and secondly by that of all the thinking men past and present, who directly or indirectly contribute to the production of the goods or services he buys with the money he earns. This stupendous magnification of each man's rational efficacy through association with other rational men, the fact that it applies to men of all degrees of ability, that there is a place in the association for everyone who thinks, this renders absurd the idea that there could be anything but a harmony of the rightly understood self-interests of all men. Man the thinker is a value to man. Rationality, however, is not automatic. Thinking is a process of choice which requires an effort to perform. On a desert island, an irrational man is a danger only to himself. In a society of men, however, he may become a danger to others. How? Not by any refusal to participate in society. The absence or withdrawal of anything he has to contribute, whether his knowledge, his labor, or his property, is not a danger. It does not stop others from taking the actions required to live. There is only one way he can become a danger to others, by resorting to force. Since the concept of force is often poorly understood, I had better define it. Force means physically doing something to or with the person or property of another against his will. Examples are killing, hitting, dragging, tying up, or pointing a knife or gun at a person, and taking away, occupying, or otherwise employing a possession of another against his will. Initiated force simply means starting the use of force. Examples are murder, assault, rape, robbery, and theft. Fraud and violation of contract are further examples of initiated force. Libel and slander are still others. In fraud, one takes the property of another against his real will, for the non-operation of which one is responsible. In contract violation, one misappropriates or refuses to hand over or deliver what is another's property, and thus one employs it against his will. In libel and slander, one destroys the reputation of another, which is his property because it is his creation. Force is the only means by which one man can destroy the life of another. He destroys it either directly, by immediate physical destruction, or indirectly, by breaking the power of his victim's mind to direct his actions, or by breaking the power of his actions to serve his life. Hitting and killing are acts of direct physical destruction of another's person. Dragging, tying up, or pointing a knife or gun at a person break the power of the victim's mind to direct his actions. His limbs are either made physically unable to follow the judgment of his mind at all, or can only follow it at the price of his physical destruction. Since the mind is man's tool of survival, since human life rests upon self-generated action based on the judgment of the mind, the breaking of one's mind's power to direct one's actions, save at the price of one's destruction, is an act destructive of one's life. Robbery, theft, fraud, contract violation, libel and slander break the power of the victim's actions to serve his life. Since one's life must be sustained by the consequences of one's actions, these too are acts destructive of one's life. Standing as his philosophical guardian against the use of force are man's rights. A right has been defined by Ayn Rand as, quote, a moral principle defining and sanctioning a man's freedom of action in a social context, unquote. And she has described rights as, quote, conditions of existence required by man's nature for his proper survival, end quote. The base of all rights, the standard of right and wrong and of good and evil, is man's life. It is right for man to live. The conditions of existence required for man's life are those in which he can act upon the judgment of his mind and use, keep, and dispose of the products of his action. From the right to life follows the right to take the actions necessary to sustain life, which is the right to liberty, and the right to use, keep, and dispose of the products of one's actions, which is the right to property. And because happiness is the consequence of successful living, the right to the pursuit of happiness follows as the sum of all other rights. Rights pertain to actions, and to things only insofar as they are the product of one's actions. A man may need bread, but he has no right to it unless he has produced it or exchanged something for it. Bread is not a condition of existence. Man does not exist in a world where there is man, nature, and bread, or man, nature, and train service, or man, nature, and college educations. Bread, train service, and college educations are man's products in a world of man confronting nature with only his ability to act. What man needs and alone has a right to is the freedom to act to produce his bread, train service, and college educations, and to use them in his own interest. The notion of any right to things in themselves, outside of the context of one's actions, is a contradiction of all rights. It means that one has a right to the products of others' actions, against their will, which means a right to robbery, enslavement, and murder. Rights serve a twofold purpose, that of a positive moral sanction for the individual and of a negative moral injunction to society. As Ayn Rand puts it, quote, for every individual, a right is the moral sanction of a positive, of his freedom to act on his own judgment, for his own goals, by his own voluntary, uncoerced choice. As to his neighbors, his rights impose no obligations on them except of a negative kind, to abstain from violating his rights. End quote. As the use of force is the only means by which one man can destroy the life of another, it is the only means by which he can violate the rights of another. If rights are man's philosophical and moral guardian against the use of force, government is, or should be, his physical guardian against the use of force. Governments, as the Declaration of Independence proclaims, are instituted among men to secure their rights. That is their only proper function. Private citizens delegate to a government their right of all retaliatory use of force, save what is required in immediate self-defense. The reason for the delegation of this right is to establish what Ayn Rand terms, quote, the separation of force and whim, unquote, to place the use of retaliatory force under the control of objective laws. In accord with its function of securing individual rights, the organs of government must consist of a legislative body in which the concrete applications of man's rights may be written into objective law and penalties prescribed for their violation, a system of courts of law in which those accused of acts of force may be fairly tried and in which contractual disputes may be equitably resolved, an executive branch charged with the operation of a police force for protection against and for the apprehension and punishment of criminals, and with the operation of an armed force for protection against invasion by foreign governments. As laws are written against criminals, constitutions and bills of rights are written against governments. A government represents in every country the overwhelmingly greatest single concentration of the ability to use force. Criminals possess knives and pistols. Governments possess machine guns, tanks, and H-bombs. A government, therefore, is always a potentially far greater threat to men's lives than any criminal gang. One's chances of surviving the James Gang or the Capone mob were reasonable. One's chances of surviving the Gestapo were not, nor are they of surviving the Russian secret police. The purpose of a Constitution and Bill of Rights is to make it illegal for the government to initiate the use of force. Their function is to secure man's rights against the government. The means by which they do this are various, among them being the division of powers among the various organs and levels of government, compelling the government to limit its actions exclusively to the enforcement of previously established laws, and never to exceed its authority under the law, and above all, by setting forth negative injunctions to the government, as in our own Bill of Rights, which specifically prohibit it from violating man's rights, and which make legislation in violation of man's rights illegal. Freedom, in its political sense, means the absence of legally initiated force on the part of the government. If the government of a free country initiates the use of force against any citizen, it is breaking the law, and the officials responsible will be punished under the law. In a free country, what one is free of or from is initiated force by the government. What one is free to do is thus whatever one's abilities permit one to do, based on one's own voluntary, uncoerced choice, without fear of being fined, imprisoned, executed, having one's taxes raised, or in any other way being threatened or harassed by the government. To give some specific examples of freedom, 1. The citizen of a fully free country can produce goods and services which the government may not want produced, or want him to produce, and by methods and in quantities to which it objects. 2. He can charge or offer prices which the government thinks are improper. 3. He can work hours and in conditions and for wages that the government does not like. 4. He can withhold his labor from all employments which he deems to be against his self-interest, any governmental objections notwithstanding. This means he does not have to join the army. 5. He can buy or sell companies, arrange mergers, combinations, and trusts, even though the government disapproves. 6. He can spend his own income as he sees fit, despite the wishes of the government. 7. He can print or say what the government does not want printed or said. 8. He can hold, practice, and preach moral, scientific, and religious doctrines which the government may consider to be false and vicious. One can do any or all of these things in a free country without fear that the government will resort to force against one. The enemies of freedom seek to obliterate its meaning by a gross equivocation. For freedom to do whatever the peaceful exercise of one's abilities permit, they substitute freedom to do whatever one's whims present. For freedom of or from initiated force on the part of the government, they substitute freedom of or from all obstacles to the realization of one's whims, that is, the absence of reality. Thus, they claim, it is a restriction on one's freedom that one is compelled by the facts of reality to work for a living, or that one earns only a low income. They say that these circumstances deprive one of the, quote, freedom to travel, or of the freedom to buy a new car or a college education, in quotes. They further claim, in the belief they have demonstrated a contradiction in the concept of freedom, that it is always necessary and a good thing to have the government violate at least some freedoms, for example, what they call the freedom to commit murder. The concept of freedom rests on a whole chain of prior concepts and propositions, starting with existence exists, and of which I have attempted to give the briefest possible presentation. These prior concepts and propositions are part of the concept of freedom, for they are inseparable from it. The concept of freedom takes for granted that one lives in reality and is thus not free to square circles, walk through walls, live without working, or have any level of income one may arbitrarily desire. It presupposes the concept of force, the distinction between initiated and retaliatory force, the concept of rights and the concept of government. It takes for granted that in the same way that one has no freedom to defy reality, one has no freedom to resort to force without being met by greater force. It is on this foundation that the concept is then formed of one specific thing which is to be absent and which one is to be free of or from, namely, initiated force on the part of the government. Then, being free of that, as well as the force of other individuals, one is free to do, within the context of the laws of nature, one's own knowledge, capacities, and wealth, and the necessity of obtaining only the voluntary cooperation of other individuals, whatever, in one's own judgment, it is best for one to do. To take some examples, 150 years ago, it was impossible to go from New York to California, perhaps in less than 3 months' time. One had no freedom to fly in then non-existent jet planes. But one was a free man. One was free to use the means one did possess to go to California, for the government's force could not be employed to stop one. One was free to book passage on a sailing vessel, or to go on horseback, if one could pay for the passage or if one owned a horse. One was not free to stow away or to steal a horse, but one was free to use the means one had to get to California. Today, in Russia, one is free to go from Moscow to Magnitogorsk in a cattle car, and at government expense, rather than walk there. One is likewise free to go to college, also at government expense, but in Russia one is a slave. Forcibly stripped of all personal wealth, those whose labor must meet the government's expense for college educations and for everything else, even the cattle cars which are to take them to Siberia when they refuse, are not free to employ even their own legs to get out of Russia. If one attempts it, one will be murdered by the Russian government, in the same way that East Germans are cut down trying to escape from their slave pen. One other example is appropriate. Today, if one wishes to enter the steel industry and to be able to produce on a competitive basis, one must have disposal over a capital of perhaps $50 million. This is a fact of reality which prevents the neighborhood grocer from becoming a steel producer. However, his freedom is in no way violated by this fact, any more than it is by the fact that he cannot win next year's Academy Award for Best Actor of the Year or the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. An example of a real violation of the freedom of entry into the steel business, however, would be a governmental prohibition from entering of someone who did have disposal over the necessary capital and who wanted to enter the steel business. If, for example, General Motors wished to enter the steel business by buying out or combining with some major steel company, and the government prevented it, that would be a violation of the freedom of entry. A fully free country, with the government serving solely as the guardian of man's rights, means a social system in which the person, property, and liberty of each man are inviolate and sacred, and in which men deal with one another solely by means of reason and peaceful persuasion, to discover and benefit from the mutual harmony of their rational self-interests. Such a social system is one of unrestricted selfishness, of unrestricted individual value-seeking. Other people cease to be a forced burden upon one, a legally imposed obstacle to the achievement of one's values. They cease to have any physical power to restrain one from seeking that which one judges to be in the service of one's life. The metaphysical conditions of existence man would face if he were alone on a desert island are recreated in the company of other men, with this difference. The power and efficacy of his thought are incalculably expanded by the multiplication and division of knowledge and by the division of labor. In such a social system, one has only to consider what one can do and what is best for one to do, and then seek to profit by it. One has only to think, to act, and to keep the result. When two or more men perceive that their self-interests are served by cooperating with one another, they do so. When they do not perceive it, none can be forced to sacrifice his values. In a word, man is free to live by the terms of John Galt's oath. Quote, I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine. End quote. The economic consequences of unrestricted individual value-seeking are all-pervasive, unremitting economic competition and ever-increasing material prosperity. The psychological consequences are happiness and benevolence toward others. Happiness, because every incentive exists to think and act for one's self-interest, and in degree that one does this, one is engaged in a process of successful living, of which happiness is the consequence. Benevolence toward others, because one comes to perceive them more and more as beings of objective value and as a source of good, not evil, to oneself. Others cease to be the looters and moochers of the world, but instead those with whom one deals to mutual advantage, who have values to offer for values received. Competition is a concept which pertains to the actions of living organisms in a context in which two or more organisms seek one and the same identical value. It may be defined as that aspect of value-seeking action which is the excluding from the one and the same identical value sought of all others who seek it. Competition follows from the fact that one and the same identical material value cannot be achieved by more than one organism. The one organism's achievement of it necessarily excludes all others from its achievement. Its action to achieve it, by the very nature of the case, must tend to exclude all others from its achievement. The economic competition which takes place among human beings in a free country is not the product of rats racing for the same piece of cheese. It is an aspect of human value-seeking, a subject about which the enemies of capitalism, of human values, and of human life have much to learn. The one central value sought in free economic competition, the focal point of all the others, is money, in the form of revenue or income. Dollar chasing is an apt metaphorical description of the economic focus of individual value-seeking, even though the expression originated as a slur, as did the very term capitalism. How does one chase dollars? By sending after them goods and services. The method of material value-seeking of rational men, the method in capitalism, is the creation of wealth, not the grabbing off, of a limited supply of nature-given means of existence. Animals employ strength, speed, and the keenness of their senses to find values which already exist in nature. Man employs reason to create and produce values which do not exist in nature, and then uses those values to acquire, by means of exchange, another man-made value, money, with which he ultimately obtains values created by others in the same way as he has created his. Competition in capitalism results from the fact that two or more men employ reason in creating material values which they seek to exchange against the same or against the same portion of the material values created by one or more other men. The strongest competitor in capitalism is not the lion with the mightiest teeth and claws, but the man with the best practical intelligence, the man with the most powerful reasons to offer other men for their trade. Their trade, or a portion of their trade, is the value from which all others are excluded. They are excluded by the continuous creation and offering of the best and the most. Competition is all-pervasive and unremitting, and material prosperity ever-increasing in capitalism, because no area of production or trade, from the smallest to the greatest, is closed to anyone's reason or to his action based on his reason by anyone else's gun or club. If a man perceives that electric light would be superior to the candle, or that electricity produced from atomic power would be superior to that produced from coal, no law, no edict, no pressure group prevents him from producing it. If a man perceives how postal or telephone or transportation service could be better rendered, or the treatment of cancer or heart disease better effected, no laws prohibit him from rendering or effecting them better. Whoever discovers or perceives how anything might be better done than it is being done, or how anything that should be done but which is not being done could be done, has only to do it, and he cannot be stopped. He has only to place either his product or the idea behind his product to the test of the judgment of those whose trade he seeks. If their judgment agrees with his, that what he has done is an improvement, then he acquires their trade, which he keeps only so long as he continues to offer them the most and the best, which in their judgment they can find for it. So soon as a more inventive or perceptive mind offers them something they consider still better, their trade is lost. The effect of free economic competition, more fundamentally the effect of that which gives rise to it, unrestricted individual value-seeking, on the so-called weaker members of the species, that is to say on the less intellectually endowed, is the precise opposite of the effect individual value-seeking and competition have in the animal kingdom. What one man gains by means of his greater intelligence makes possible a gain to all other men, most particularly to those of lesser intelligence. To realize their gain, they have only to do one thing: use the intelligence they do possess, as he has used his. First of all, the competition of capitalism is a process of exclusion in only two respects. One, with every dollar of revenue one earns, one excludes all others from that dollar of revenue and from the trade which gives it to one by the fact of earning it. One does not, however, exclude anyone from the earning of any revenue or trade whatever. 2. One's advantages for earning revenue in particular capacities, resulting from the quality of one's mind, one's knowledge, one's person, one's property, all of which are employed in value-seeking and thus in competition, exclude others from the earning of revenue only in certain capacities, not from the earning of revenue in every capacity. Thus, the owner of a neighborhood grocery or tailoring shop is precluded from earning his living by producing steel in his backyard, along the lines of the Chinese Great Leap Forward. He is stopped by the superior capital, technological knowledge, and intelligence of the enterprisers of the giant steel concerns. But he is not stopped from earning his living in the grocery or tailoring business. On the contrary, it is the enterprisers of the giant steel concerns who are precluded from earning their livings in the grocery or tailoring business. They are precluded by the higher incomes and greater satisfaction they can earn in the steel business, even though they could probably run grocery stores and tailoring shops more efficiently than the men who do run them. Too much ability is as much a barrier to attempting to compete in certain capacities as too little ability. Thus, while illiterate or semi-literate persons cannot be engineers, those with the ability to be engineers are prevented by the greater rewards of engineering from being longshoremen or taxi drivers. This principle is a wider application of Ricardo's law of comparative advantage in international trade, discovered, I believe, by von Mises, and called by him the law of association. It demonstrates that there is room for all in the competition of capitalism, at the appropriate level of ability in the division of labor. A successful competitor in capitalism receives nothing which is not merely the exchange equivalent of what he himself has created. And he receives that because what he creates is judged by the men with whom he trades to be the best and most that they can obtain with what they must turn over to him. An unsuccessful competitor is not thereby debarred from production and trade. His powers of production continue, undiminished. He need only produce something else, and thus relocate himself in the system of division of labor and exchange. And then, in most cases, the only lasting effect for him will be that he too has derived an addition to his previous standard of living from the competition that he lost, in quotes. He will then stand in the same position with regard to the victor as do all other men. He will be the beneficiary of an improvement he did not make, and which, in the enormous majority of cases, he would not have had the intellectual ability to make. As an illustration of the effects of competition under capitalism, especially on the so-called weak, and even more fundamentally as a base for insight into the nature of the harmony of men's interests in all aspects of individual value-seeking under capitalism, let us take the example of Henry Ford. Henry Ford was an eminently successful value-seeker. The value which he sought was the dollars of vehicle buyers. He achieved this value so completely that all buggy and wagon companies were driven from the field. Ford earned the dollars they had previously earned. The goods and services which he could buy with the funds he earned were the equivalent of the goods and services he had produced. What was the effect of Ford's value achievement on the rest of the human race? Men of equal intelligence, who might have originated the idea of a moving assembly line or interchangeable mass-produced parts, but whose time was taken up with introducing comparable improvements into other fields, such as the petroleum industry, the steel industry, or theoretical science, obtained automobiles and trucks in place of buggies and wagons in exchange for the dollars they earned. The position of men of lesser intelligence in all other fields was affected in the same way. Men who could not have originated the Ford products had only to perceive their superiority to buggies and wagons and to act on their perception. The effect was that as consumers, other men had the pleasure of automobiles in place of buggies, and as producers, the benefit of using trucks in place of wagons, thereby enabling them to increase their own ability to produce. What was the effect on the ex-buggy makers and wagon builders? They had to find new jobs. To do that, what they had to do was to learn new skills. By doing so, they too were then enabled to drive automobiles as consumers and to work with the aid of trucks as producers, though they lacked the intelligence to originate these things. Economic theory can demonstrate the theoretical and practical possibility of almost every wage earner displaced by any improvement in production ending up in a relatively short period of time with a standard of living different from his previous standard of living only by virtue of having the benefit of the improvement in production which originally displaced him. What economic theory cannot demonstrate is the necessity of displaced employers and wage earners with extremely rare, highly specialized, highly paid skills ending up with a higher standard of living than that which they enjoyed prior to such an improvement's introduction. The owner of a buggy company in 1910, who lost $1 million, would most likely be unable to reaccumulate $1 million in another line of work, or any amount of wealth even approaching $1 million, while his employees of average income would almost certainly be able to find other jobs offering comparable income. If he lived long enough, perhaps another 20 or 25 years, the cumulative improvements in all other fields might enable him finally to have a higher standard of living even as a low-paid clerk than he had originally enjoyed as a millionaire. The progress capitalism brings about is that rapid. One is materially better off even today as a $5,000 per year wage earner than as a millionaire of only 25 years ago. Improvements in life-saving drugs and surgery alone more than compensate. But it must be admitted that the effect of any isolated improvement in production is, almost certainly, necessarily to reduce the standard of living of some people for the remainder of their lives. The greater the previously accumulated wealth they lose in competition with the improvement, and the older they are, the more likely will it be that they will never make up their loss. And for a somewhat larger number of people, the period of time which must elapse before they can finally come out ahead of where they were before the improvement was introduced may be considerable, and this must be admitted. However, the reduction in anyone's standard of living, briefly, for a long period of time, or permanently, is not the standard by which competition or individual value-seeking is to be judged. Nor is the standard of judgment the fact that the number of those whose living standards are increased by it exceeds the number of those whose living standards are decreased by it. The standard is that reason is man's tool of survival and that it is the unalienable right of each individual man to employ his reason in behalf of his life, no matter which or how many other people's standard of living may appear to be or in fact be reduced by it. The fact that some men may have losses in their standard of living as the result of a specific competition or any other aspect of individual value-seeking does not imply a conflict of interest between them and the other members of society. A conflict only arises if their standard of their interests is their out-of-context arbitrary desires, in which case their interests deserve no consideration. In the words of Ayn Rand, there are no conflicts of interest among rational men. A rational competitor who takes a loss does not claim his interests are harmed. He identifies his interests as being served by the operation of principles, the foremost of which is human action based on the cognition of the facts of reality. As a principle, it applies equally to himself and to all others, permitting of no exceptions. He does not ask to live in a society in which other men are to be rational about the building of his house and the installation of its plumbing, and in the production of all the other things he buys, but less than rational when it comes to producing in competition with him. He does not ask that those with whom he trades be rational when his good or service is the best, but less than rational when someone else's is. He does not ask for contradictions. He does not see his loss out of context. He knows that any standard of living he enjoyed prior to the introduction of the improvement that causes his loss was only possible to the extent that he and others were free to be rational, and that the proper measure of the effects of rationality is not the difference between his present standard of living and the highest point it had ever reached, but the difference between his present standard of living and zero. He sees that in the full context of his life, his loss is not a loss, but only a diminution of his gain, for he does not take any given standard of living as an automatic nature-given gift, but sees his standard of living always as something which must be earned by him from zero on up. Any other standard of judging competition and individual value-seeking, but the unalienable right of each man to employ his reason on behalf of his own life, means the law of a land that is less than a jungle, ruled by beings that are less than animals. What would it have meant if the owner of a buggy factory or his employees had declared that Ford must be stopped because of the loss, real or imagined, they will suffer? What does it mean whenever anyone asserts that the actions of another must be stopped merely because of the economic loss one believes one will suffer, and irrespective of the fact that the loss results from another's rightful action? It would have been, and always is, a demand that other men's rationality be overridden in the name of one's whim. In the case of Ford, it would have been a demand that he should be forced to ignore the fact that he has discovered how to mass-produce automobiles and trucks, and that this is the means to his fortune and to his customers' progress and prosperity. It would have been a demand that he and his customers should be forced to blind themselves to the evidence of their senses and the judgment of their minds, and to affirm, by their actions, that despite all they see and know, the buggy is nonetheless the superior of the automobile, and the wagon the superior of the truck. The nature of the demand is no different whenever any businessman, wage earner, farmer, or anyone else is forced to take any action he knows or understands to be against his self-interest to take, or is forced not to take any action he knows or understands to be in his self-interest to take. Always it is a demand that the facts of reality be obliterated. Thus, when railroads or theaters are forced to employ men they know to be against their interest to employ, they are compelled to join in the pretense that what useless firemen or electricians are doing is work. When a corporation is forced not to combine with another corporation that it knows to be in its interest to combine with, it is forced to act against its knowledge that combination means greater efficiency and greater profits. When a taxpayer is forced to dispose of his wealth in ways he knows to be against his interest to dispose of it, he is forced to act in contradiction of his knowledge of the facts. Of the fact, for example, that a night out with his wife is of value to his life, while textbooks for dropouts are not of value to his life. A man's self-interest is a fact of reality logically necessitating a specific course of action in every given set of circumstances. To force him to act against his understanding of how to serve his self-interest is always to force him to act against the evidence of his senses and the judgment of his mind, and thus to live a lie. Morally, it is not one iota less reprehensible than was the forcing of Galileo to act in denial of his knowledge of the solar system, a knowledge of facts logically necessitating an action only because the statement of scientific truth is a value necessitated by the fact of man's life, the base of all of his self-interest. Nor is the motive for the use of force any different whether against Galileo, a railroad, or anyone else. It is used so that a wish divorced from fact, a desire contradicting reality, may be maintained. In the one case, someone's automatic, not to be proved, but revealed truth. In the other case, someone's automatic, not to be earned, but received standard of living. And the practical consequences of compelling action against reason? The Middle Ages, Soviet Russia, and every dictatorship in the history of the world provide sufficient evidence. The overwhelming practical success of capitalism stems from the fact that it is the only system which removes all obstacles to the operation of man's two highest, inseparable, corollary moral virtues, selfishness and the use of reason. Selfishness is the only thing which can make an action rational, make it follow from the facts. Rationality is the only thing which can make an action selfish, make it serve oneself. The self is a fact of reality. It is one's mind and body, one's life. And it is, as Ayn Rand has demonstrated, the fact of life which is the only possible base of values. But for man to serve his self, he must be rational. He must discover and identify the facts both of his own nature and of the nature of his environment. Thus, only action based on selfishness can be rational, and only action based on reason can be selfish. In perceiving the nature of his self and of the facts of his environment in relation to it, man has the sole basis of logical, rational, fact-derived action. and it is only such action which can be of value either to himself or to anyone else. In 1776, Adam Smith wrote, quote, "He, the individual, generally indeed, neither intends to promote the public interest nor knows how much he is promoting it. He intends only his own gain. And he is in this, as in many other cases, led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Nor is it always the worse for the society that it was no part of it. By pursuing his own interest, he frequently promotes that of the society more effectually than when he really intends to promote it. I have never known much good done by those who affected to trade for the public good. It is an affectation, indeed, not very common among merchants, and very few words need be employed in dissuading them from it." End quote. Smith's metaphorical invisible hand is a necessary consequence of man's nature as a rational being, and is present in all dealings men have with one another, provided only they choose to be selfish. For the only fundamental value that one man can derive from another is the benefit of his rational action. But rational action always consists in selfish action, in action that is based on one's own life as the purpose, while holding man's life as the standard. Can a man benefit in a particular isolated instance from the irrational, unselfish actions of others on his behalf, performed either under force or voluntarily? No. A successful bank robber, for example, may gain money by his holdups. But what he gives for the money is that from which the value of money is derived, his self-esteem. In resorting to force against others, he defines himself in his own mind as a being who is a fit object for the use of force by others. He obtains money, a means, at the price of destroying the end, his own value. His action is comparable to that of a madman who would try to reverse the nature of production, and instead of seeking iron ore for the purpose of obtaining iron and steel products, seek to obtain it by a reduction process entailing the destruction of all iron and steel products. As for any benefit to be obtained from the voluntary, unselfish actions of others on one's behalf, I refer you to Atlas Shrugged, to the section on what the consequences would have been if John Galt had sacrificed his love for Dagny Taggart on behalf of Francisco d'Anconia. What is obtained from others by their own falsehood is of no greater value than what is obtained from them by force. In economic activity, the standard of self-interest derived from man's life is monetary profitability, and this is the standard of economic rationality. If the profitable thing for a railroad to do is to fire certain employees, that is the logical and rational thing for it to do, just as much as when one's leg is broken, the logical and rational thing to do is to call a doctor. If the profitable thing for a corporation to do is to merge with one or more of its competitors, that is the logical and rational thing for it to do, just as much as when one is hungry, the logical and rational thing to do is to eat. And so it is in every case. It is not the self-interest, but only the whims of others, which can be adversely affected by anyone's selfish, profitable, rational action. And it is not the self-interest of anyone that can be served by another's unselfish, unprofitable, irrational action, but again, only his whims. The self-interest of all, as distinct from their whims, can be served only by the selfishness and profit-making of each, never by unselfishness and non-profit-making. For they can be served only by rationality, never by irrationality. Anti-capitalism does not believe either that man is an end in himself or that his actions can be rational. The rejection of the first implies the rejection of the second, for it obliterates the base of rational values, man's life. Its standard of value, whatever the particular differences among its various sects may be, is always the non-life, the non-self-interest, non-profit of the individual. That is the defining characteristic of its standard of value, whether it be the good of the proletariat, of the Aryan race, of the public, or of Pharaoh. Its tool for achieving its standard of value is force. It should not be surprising, therefore, that with the non-life, non-self-interest, non-profit of the individual as its end, and force as its means, anti-capitalism achieves for man nothing but misery, destruction, and death. It is not capitalism which is the system of dog-eat-dog and the law of the jungle. Capitalism holds as its first principles the supreme value of man's life and the unfettered operation of his rationality, before which nothing is to stand. Rather, it is anti-capitalism, which seeks to place guns in the hands of men who choose to function beneath the level of animals by holding their reason in contempt before their random whims and stray emotions. That is the system not of the law of the jungle, but of the law of the fetid swamp, where leeches eat men. Capitalism has never fully existed anywhere on Earth, but it was within men's reach in the United States in the 19th century. Despite a number of important flaws and inconsistencies, the United States was a country conceived in reason and dedicated to the proposition that the pursuit of happiness is man's unalienable right. It was on the foundation of what was almost a moral utopia that what is almost a physical utopia was built, the economy of the United States. Our economic history may be summarized in a single sentence. Everyone thought about the facts of reality in relation to his own self-interest and acted on the basis of his thinking. And everyone was successful in achieving his self-interest, each in proportion to the extent of his thinking and in proportion to his intelligence. It was that simple. Millions of people, when their minds were not on the work they were currently doing, were thinking of ways to do more demanding, more rewarding work. This was expressed in their concern for making money and making ever more money. They were those dollar-chasing Americans, as the degenerate aristocrats and government clerks of Europe called them. They continuously solved the problem of how to do more demanding work, and continuously succeeded in making ever more money. The cumulative aggregate result of all this selfish thinking is a continent containing the 200 million richest people in the history of the Earth, a continent whose cities either did not exist or were little more than coastal villages in 1776, and whose 3 million inhabitants of that time were almost all semi-self-sufficient farmers. How did it happen? Where did Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Detroit, Chicago, St. Louis, San Francisco, and Los Angeles come from? How did New York City grow from a population of 20,000 to 8 million, and Boston and Philadelphia increase in size 35 and 100 times over? Where did all of the factories and houses and stores and all of the incredible goods that fill them come from? The answer is simple. Eastern farmers perceived that the land in the Midwest and Far West was better for many purposes than was the land in the East, and that a higher income was to be made by moving there. They moved. Merchants perceived the need of these farmers for supplies, and the money to be made in supplying them. They opened clusters of stores and built their houses at supply points in proximity to the farmers, thus laying the base of towns and cities. They made money and expanded their operations. Others perceived the growing trade and the money to be made in improving transportation to the new regions. They built barge lines and stagecoach lines, then steamship companies and railroads, and made more and more money. Businessmen and inventors, often one and the same, were constantly on the search for the new and the better. They discovered and introduced thousands upon thousands of improvements, both in products and in methods of production, with each new advance and the money made from it serving as the base for something still newer, still better, still more profitable. These businessmen and inventors built the factories and the industries that made the cities and made the country. The rest of the population, always on the lookout for better jobs, perceived the advantages of employment in the ever-new industries and the new cities, and so took the ever-improving, ever-higher-paying jobs they offered. Why did all this happen? Because it was selfish, and because it was rational, and because no one had the guns to stop it. The rising prosperity of each generation brought about a continuous doubling and redoubling of the population, as proportionately more and more children could survive to adulthood, and as an ever-growing flood of immigrants bought, borrowed, and literally stole their way to the shores of what they called God's country. God's country, where the streets are paved with gold, as the immigrants put it, to express their awe and admiration for the United States. That was the United States in the 19th century, the freest, most rational, most selfish, most rapidly progressing, and happiest nation ever to have existed. It was the wonder, the marvel, the openly professed ideal of the world in every respect. What the United States represented in the 19th century was almost capitalism. let us not look at what it represents today. And perhaps in the next century, or the one after that, what the United States almost was will be, for the spirit of that United States will never be buried, but will surely rise up again to sweep aside those who are ashamed of it and to bury those who would bury it.